The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Sarah Crown.
Got a feel of something that's going to be here for a while and hopefully make a difference.
We are going to stay here as a visual reminder to everyone of the injustice which the 99% of the population is suffering from due to the concentration of the wealth in the hands of the few.
It's been yet another year in which our lives have been dominated by money on both the national and international stages. These are the voices of the protesters of the London Occupy movement, among them the performance poet Pete the Temp.
Now is the winter of our discount tents, where people regroup from their TV sets and start to set out the new news agenda. There are polythene estates appearing all over the place, camped out new fields of possibilities. We meld and become one body, soldered by the tent pegs of love and solidarity. I'm Spartacus. Slogans detonate like shockwaves inside my brain as I stand here gazing at neoclassical pillars, which start to get plastered with our collected answers to this cardiac-arresting capital city, they read. Nature is the only superpower, they read. Your heart is a weapon the size of a fist, they read. Make occupation your occupation, and on and on, and fierce discussions erupt on street corners. It's like 18th century France all over again. The pendulum is beginning to swing. We're at the point of zero gravity between more of the same.
Occupy London has taken over a huge abandoned office block in the borough of Hackney belonging to the investment bank UBS in a move it describes as a public repossession. We hope this is the first in a wave of public repossessions of property belonging to the companies that crashed the global economy.
People from Syria are also here protesting at the same time, so we're trying to link the protests in Damascus and the people protesting here via a live link.
Even though the latest leg of the economic crisis began as long ago as 2008, the literary world, with its long lead times, has been comparatively slow to catch up. There have been plenty of articles, blogs, plays and documentaries on the downturn, but not a great deal of extended writing. This year, though, the pace has picked up. In Super Sad True Love Story, Gary Steingart set America on the edge of an economic abyss. Anne Enright relived the death of the Celtic tiger in The Forgotten Waltz. And here in the UK, we've had Other People's Money, a State of the Nation novel from Justin Cartwright, and This Bleeding City, a first-time novel set in the world of hedge fund managers during the financial collapse by ex-banker Alex Preston. When the two of them came into the studio this week, I asked them whether they sympathised with the Occupy movement.
Just verbal outrage. Whether it's strictly moral, I don't really know. But yes, I mean, clearly there's something went horribly wrong, and clearly the people who made it all go wrong have got up way too lightly.
I think whether they're over the top or not, they're very much needed. They're a bit like the films of Michael Moore, who I notice is supporting them in the States, that they're kind of so in your face because actually everything else is against them. The whole kind of superstructure of society is against what they're doing. And so it's necessary that you have these kind of very, very vocal, very obvious voices to protest, because that's actually what we should all be doing.
And so were your novels then, you've both written novels about the recent financial situation and the people involved in it, were these novels a form of protest as well? Did you feel that that was what you were doing when you were writing, Justin?
I didn't specifically think of it as a form of protest. No, I set out the intention of writing a State of the Nation novel, and obviously times like this are very interesting and a lot easier for a novelist. And I don't write specifically on specific moral issues. I haven't written specifically about apartheid in South Africa. And not because, of course, was unaware it was an important issue, but just I thought it was very black and white.
I was horribly compromised, obviously, given that I wrote the novel while I was still working in the city. Moral outrage or a kind of understandable wish when my son asked me, Dad, what were you doing during that hideous credit crisis all those years ago? I didn't say, yeah, that was me. I did that. But also, you know, I think there was a kind of different moral thing going on, which was the representation of the city of finance was getting so barbelled between the good anti-capitalist or the good, you know, everyday Joe and the evil city, you know, Lex Luthor comic book villains that I felt that actually pushed us away from understanding. And I did feel a moral obligation that people needed to know what was going on behind those sort of extraordinary glass facades, and people did need to understand the mechanics of what was going on. And of course, the best way to understand things is through the vehicle of a story, through fiction, because that's how our minds work.
And so, as you said, you worked in the city for a few years.
9 years.
Presumably then the challenge to each of you must have been a different challenge, because for you, Alex, presumably the idea was you knew very intimately the world and what happened in it. You were familiar with everything going on in there, but you needed to humanise something that for most of us is quite an impenetrable thing. And for you, Justin, presumably the opposite was true. You had to immerse yourself in a world that, for the likes of you and I, is fairly cabalistic.
Yes, I mean, it wasn't totally a mystery. Quite a lot of friends of mine had worked in banking and I'd spoken to them. I spoke to one at the time, the Leeson affair, and I think he was suggesting that they really knew something was going on, but while the bonuses were coming in, they didn't want to look too closely. Mm. And it struck me, the more I talked to people about it, that there was a kind of complicit culture of not being strictly illegal, but not being overly ethical.
And that's exactly what you go into your novel, isn't it?
It is, and I try to look at the people as characters first rather than caricatures. You know, that was how I started. I'd read a couple of other financial novels, and they often seem to be bogged down with the, you know, what the nature of the fraud was or what the nature of the financial transaction was. And it struck me that it was way better to see how that affected people and how they became involved, how they compromised themselves. I also try to suggest that there's a lot more in life than money, and one of those things is basically art, an artistic endeavour, whatever sort it is. And that is a form of truth as well.
Let's talk a bit more generally about the idea of financial novels. It seems to me that back in, you know, the 1900s, novelists were absolutely unashamed about having money front and centre in their books. And you think of Dickens, Trollope, even Austen to an extent. But then it kind of receded from view, I think, certainly towards the late 20th century. And I was trying to think of the great novel of the 1990s recession. I couldn't really call one to mind.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's very interesting. And actually, I think it was the weekend after Lehman Brothers went down, Will Skidelsky in The Observer wrote a very interesting piece saying, where is the Dickens of our time? Why aren't people engaging with this extraordinary story that is unfolding? And, you know, along came Sebastian Foulkes' A Week in December, along came Justin's Other People's Money, and along is coming next year John Lanchester's Capital, all of which seem to me to be, you know, on the nose answers to exactly that question. So I think it's very interesting that people had ignored it, and, you know, you've obviously got Bonfire of the Vanities, Bonfire of the Vanities stands there almost on its own, whereas, as you say, if you look back further, you've not only got the Trollopes and obviously Dickens, but you've got names that are maybe forgotten now, people like Frank Norris, who were great, great chroniclers of...
Just talking about him earlier on
today. He's an amazing novelist. And The Pit is the ultimate, I think still the ultimate novel about financial speculation and a moral banker. It disappeared and now I think it's come back.
So I'm glad you mentioned Bonfire of the Vanities because, I mean, Tom Sharp actually said it was a conscious attempt to write a Victorian novel. So that's always lingered on, and there have been novels in the cracks. I myself wrote one in 1993 or 92, it was published, called Look at It This Way, which was about the central incident was a financial scandal in the city. But what has changed a bit, too, is that it's so much more complicated. When you have a Melmotte or somebody, you have an out-and-out villain. Mm. You know, when Trollope wrote about the morals of the times, he said it just seems to that dishonesty has moved to a higher plane, you know. the day he sat down to write The Way we Live Now. And it was so similar to the situation now, equivocation about the morality of money.
Yeah, he's a Dick Fuld character, isn't he? He's just like so. One of these CEOs. Yeah, yeah. And Myrtle is Bernie Madoff.
Yeah. Do you know, Dickens, it was very much, I mean, all the financiers were villains.
You put a lovely quote in the book from a letter of Charles Dickens where he refers to bankers as these kind of slobbering, snivelling, paunched
beasts.
Cattle.
Yeah. So do you think, is it then that the reason why we're starting to see books about finance again now, and I was thinking as well, we've had Anne Enright was writing really about the Irish crash,
yep,
and
absolutely.
Roddy Doyle as well, perhaps because Ireland's crash happened earlier, so they've managed to get in a bit more quickly. But do you think that the reason why these books are happening again is because we feel that sort of disgust with what's been going on in a way that everything was a bit more nuanced and we were less certain. It was, as he'd said before, less black and white up to this point now. But suddenly we've recast things along the old lines of these are the villains and the rest of us aren't.
I don't know about that, because actually I think that what you have, very interestingly, is all of these books, all the books we've been talking about, have got much more nuanced views of what's going on. So I don't think it's presenting this Manichaean divide between the good and the bad. I think, you know, Justin's book, maybe A Week in December, I thought, but I thought that was one of its weaknesses, was that the banker character was this emotionally warped, unpleasant. I think the reason these are coming out now is because authors are drawn into the subject matter, but they also realise that it is a subject that makes rich fictional territory.
Do you think literature has a responsibility to help us make sense of the state that we're in, the financial state we're in?
I'd put it differently. I'd say that very, very good novels or literature gives you an insight, regardless, that you almost by starting out to preach, you lose the plot, I think. One's aim is to be very sensitive, express it well. And what is a joy in a novel is to read something that you've intuited, but you've never heard it expressed that way before. So I think that's the service, the many services that novelists do to the world, but that's the service in this case, where it gives a kind of much more subtle understanding of what was going on, how people behaved and how they reacted and why they jettisoned their moral standards. I think there was a sort of, as I said earlier, I think there was a complicity in the city and elsewhere. And while it was going so well, they were sure they must be doing something right. You know, you make that amount of money, you're either incredibly lucky or you believe you're doing something wonderfully. You can't be doing something wrong, because otherwise you wouldn't be getting all that amount of money. And, of course, that's an absolute fallacy.
But there was that interesting article by Zoe Williams, which set up what I think is a false opposition between the non-fictional and the fictional, the non-fictional.
She was saying that the non-fictional... I read that. Yeah. I thought it was absurd, actually, I have to say.
I don't know that I'd be that strong about it, but I strongly disagreed with the essential premise of it.
You're just a bit more polite.
You know, what would you rather read? A dry, factual account of the Napoleonic Wars in Russia or War and Peace? You know, it's this idea that in order to understand something, you live it through a novel. You don't get the blunt historical facts. You get all of the lived experience. And that is how you learn from something.
The example I would give, too, is that if you wanted to understand South Africa and apartheid, you wouldn't find it in official histories or anywhere else. You'd find it in the novels. You know, if you want to understand post-apartheid South Africa, you simply have to read J.M. Coetzee, you know, and it tells you more than you'll ever read by pouring through every possible history.
Justin, you mentioned the idea of a State of the Nation novel, but both of your novels are very firmly set in the city of London. Is it possible to write a novel about the state of the nation that's concentrated in such a very small square mileage?
Well, in my case, it wasn't concentrated entirely in London.
To go to Cornwall.
I mean, a lot of it is in Cornwall, and the sort of artist figure lives in Cornwall on his uppers, but nonetheless heroic. And the blogger who inadvertently uncovers the fact that the bank is going down the drain at high speed is just a young Cornish girl who's really an intern on a local newspaper.
I guess I didn't set out to write a State of the Nation novel. I was doing an interview with Radio Lincoln the other day, and they said, we read your novel and enjoyed it, but what does it have to say to the people of Lincoln? And I found that a difficult question, because it is very much about London, but at the same time, you know, the ramifications of what went on in 2008 in the Square Mile have been felt from Lincoln to Lahore. And, you know, so yes, it was about one person's journey through the credit crisis, but I think I hope that it said a little bit more than that and told people outside of that hermetic world of the city exactly what was going on, or something about what was going on.
Ye come here, gather round the stage. The time has come for us to voice our rage against the ones who've trapped us in a cage to steal from us the value of our wage. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few.
Alex Preston's This Bleeding City is published by Faber and Faber, and Justin Cartwright's Other People's Money by Bloomsbury. And to pick up those references to Dickens and Trollope, maybe a bit of historical perspective is appropriate here. In his latest novel, The Quality of Mercy, Barry Unsworth tackles the moment in the 18th century when capitalism was first becoming fully established. The novel stands as a sequel to Sacred Hunger, his book of the slave trade, which won the Booker Prize in 1992. I asked him why he waited 20 years to pick up the story.
I always meant to write a sequel. And in fact, before Sacred Hunger was published, I had already sketched out two or three chapters of what was supposed to be, going to be, a sequel to the novel. But then in 1992, we moved to Italy, and it remained dropped for the next sort of 18 or 20 years. Then it came home to me in a way that the slave trade, that particular period, the 1760s, which was the time when the movement for abolition was gathering pace. At the same time, children were being sent to toil in the mines and factories in the Industrial Revolution. So one kind of servitude was replacing another. And that's what set me going again, really.
We're now in 1767,
yes,
which is 2 years after the end of Sacred Hunger.
That's right.
And the very kind of convulsive conclusion to that book.
That's right.
And the crew of the Liverpool Merchant were tracked down in Florida and have all been brought back to the UK, or as many of them as survived the confrontation. And they're now in prison awaiting trial for piracy. And Erasmus Kemp, who we met in the first book, wants to see them all hanged, firstly, but secondly is also pursuing an insurance case in order to recoup the value of the slaves who were jettisoned earlier on in the voyage. And you're going to read to us a bit now from the insurance case, which comes about halfway through the book.
The captain put it to us, he said. We was assembled below in the captain's cabin, and he put it to us fair and square, 100%. Will you tell us who was present at that meeting, in addition to Captain Thurso? Waters asked. There was myself, the boatswain, the carpenter. The men who represented responsibility and authority on board the ship. And you decided, taking counsel together, that the cargo would have to be jettisoned. Is that so? 100%, sir. Fellow, what is this way of answering? Justice Blundell said, red-faced and irritable in his heavy wig. You must answer yes or no. Yes, sir, begging your pardon. A collective decision taken by the responsible members of the crew, Waters said, addressing himself to the jury. And on what grounds was this decision taken? It was taken on grounds of dire necessity. The witness will relate the circumstances. We were short of water, sir. There had been stormy weather, and one of the casks was holed unknown to us, and the water had leaked away. So there was insufficient water to go around among the crew and the slaves. Yes, sir, right in every detail. We had no choice, sir. We were still 10 days off Jamaica. We had to throw them over so as to be sure there was water enough for the crew. No choice, your worship. Those are the key words. It was a question of life or death for the crew. And if the crew perished, who was to manage the ship? That constitutes lawful jettison, and that is the contention of the ship's owner, Mr. Erasmus Kemp. whom I have the honour of representing in this court today.
And so this really gets to the central issue of the book, doesn't it, which is one of money, of value and worth, the worth that we place on human life.
On human life, yes.
And on property, that slaves are cargo and therefore to be jettisoned and can be lawfully jettisoned, or whether or not they're men and women and therefore have been murdered. And it's something that seems so outrageous to us reading it now. Mm. I wondered whether it had been a difficult thing to write about.
Difficult thing to write about. There was a historical precedent for it, the slave ship Zong, which something of the sort happened some 20 years later. This idea that Negroes on board were simply goods in the same way that timber might have been, or sacks of grain or anything else like that, was firmly held at the time. They had become property through the act of purchase. The humanity that they had before the act of purchase was cancelled by the act of purchase. And this was a period when property was a sacred concept almost.
And all of this book, it's a very procedural novel, it seems to me. It's taking the original book, Sacred Hunger, and almost kind of rereading it, passing over it again, going over the events of it again in great detail. But in this book, we are in courtrooms and dusty offices. You make a lot of the you know, the smog of London, the dirty windows. And then also, as you sort of briefly mentioned before, a lot of the action takes place up in County Durham in mines underground, where people are, you know, physically oppressed.
Oppressed, yes. I think this, to my mind, as writing, I think it reinforced this sense of restricted liberty, of captivity, of imprisonment, which runs through the book in one form or another. The mining people are made captive, as you say. They're sentenced to toil underground in the dark, in narrow spaces. At the same time, in the human relations in the book, there is a fear of being made captive. They had no voice. The Africans that were bought and sold had no voice. The crew had no voice. The only voice was the voice of the slave traders, the slave owners, global capitalism, which was burgeoning at the time. And I remember feeling that I would, with luck, be able to give them a voice. I mean, an invented voice, but grounded in history and social realities. And that's what I tried to do then. And in a way, it's what I'm trying to do here in this book too.
We are nail bombs of love and ragtag humanity, antibody to an exponential cancer of money, hacking at the tumour before it dies naturally, because only another world is possible, only another world is possible. We are purging ourselves of parasites with thriving communities of radical campsites. We want to push the banks to the brink of extinction. We're going to get Darwinian, armed with information and critical discussion, and spreading like the advancing Sahara, bearing tent poles and a sense of humour. I'm Spartacus.
So if, like most of us, you failed to find much solace in the Chancellor's autumn statement this week, I hope instead that you found our discussion of the literature of money worthwhile. Pete the Temp tells me that he's mounting a new show in the spring on climate change, so look out for that. And before we go this week, we have an announcement. Those of you who listened to last week's podcast will remember that we were in the throes of choosing a winner for the 2011 Guardian First Book Award. After a very lengthy lunch, the judges decided that the award should go to Siddhartha Mukherjee for his superb biography of cancer, The Emperor of All Maladies. So congratulations to him. It's a brilliant book. Also to look forward to this weekend, Catherine Hughes will be writing in the Guardian Review about beautiful books, and our critics will be choosing their books for giving this year. And in the Observer New Review on Sunday, as well as their Christmas roundups, Rachel Cook reviews Brian Sewell's new memoir. Thanks to Barry Unsworth, Justin Cartwright and Alex Preston. From me, Sarah Crown, and my producer Tim Mabey, goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.